So the reason for next hour and for this week is for all of us to talk to each other and come up with great ideas that no one has thought about before, and which leads to discoveries that set the course for quantum gravity for the next century. That sounds reasonable, right? Good. Right, but I think a little bit more seriously, I mean, we've been at this program for quantum gravity for like 100 years or so. And I mean, what are we doing wrong? And what can we change to make progress? Or maybe this is exactly how it's supposed to be. So just ideas. Do you think things should be done differently? Is it people, or is it our practices, or is it just our approaches? Or whether, I mean, there are like 10 different versions of quantum gravity. So yes, Carlo.
Let me try a perspective. That's the way I view things. It's possible that we're doing nothing wrong. Mm-hmm. And we're in a better shape than we are saying. And there is a reason for the fact that there are different ideas and different research programs and different theories of quantum gravity out there. And that's okay, because there are different theories of quantum gravity. Each one is more or less incomplete. Some of us don't like it. Some of us don't like pieces of it. The reasons, but they are out there. They're not many. You listed five, whatever. Somebody may think at three. Somebody may think at seven. I mean, it's, but we have theories of quantum gravity. So what do we need to crack it? We need empirical information that could select among this or support directly, and this is we don't have.
So I'm just going to act as a scribe now.
So here is, I'm getting this away. So first of all, I think we definitely do not have clear support for any theory, but we have partial indication against some theories. So we're not in the dark empirically. For instance, Rojava theory lost a lot of interest after the program for searching violations of Lorentz symmetry in astrophysics just produced nothing. The lack of supersymmetry at low energy at CERN raised a lot of doubt. I mean, sort of took away some charm from spring-related things. Well, no, I wouldn't say they're dead. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that.
So it took away charm.
other research directions are still alive. So what I'm suggesting is perhaps, first of all, nature is talking. I mean, there's no supersymmetry there. There's no Lorentz relation there. And second, maybe we don't need some big new thing. Maybe we have some. We have to just look for ways to look for confirmations.
Look for
a moment in which we get not just some negative thing, but some positive
confirmation.
Everybody who says, well, there's a theory that has some tentative predictions, maybe some of these predictions will come up right. And then we'll see.
So we're on the right track, you say?
I think that it's possible. I'm not sure. I don't know. But I think it's possible. And I don't see reason to discard this hypothesis a priori.
Can I ask a question to Carlo? So I think what you say is quite powerful. Like, if we'd found supersymmetry, it wouldn't have proven string theory, but it would have given it a boost.
Exactly.
So by not finding it, it must take a hit.
Yeah.
However, the question is, how much of a hit? The question I want to ask is, if we were debating geocentrism versus heliocentrism in the time of Brahe, and we didn't find any parallax, would you be saying nature is telling us something?
Yeah, that's why for 2,000 years people took heliocentrism. Correct. If you look at the old texts in antiquity, they didn't find parallax. But that's science. That's our limitations. That's how we learn things about nature. It seems to be, including being refused and being wrong for a while.
I was just going to say something from a historical perspective that's along the same lines as what Carlo was saying. Think about how long it took for us to discover any anomalies for Newtonian gravity. So it's, you know, 250 years, essentially. And Einstein at one point says he's very thankful for the pedantic obsession that astronomers have with accuracy that allowed them to discover the anomalous perihelion motion of Mercury. But that's, you know, almost, what, 600 arcseconds total, of which 43 is the anomaly. So it actually, you have to have a huge amount of understanding of the current theory to find the small anomalies that will give you a hint towards the further theory. And so we have learned a huge amount about what general relativity says. If you look at what Einstein thought about singularities, about the cosmology, about all the topics we've talked about today, we know far more about what his own field equations imply about those circumstances. And so I think there's a huge amount of progress. I mean, obviously it'd be more fun if progress was happening faster, but in the history of science, it seems like expecting us to be at the point of having clear anomalies for general relativity already would be, that would be really fast.
So, Ricard?
Yes, and since Susie is still striked out here and I'm starting to serve, I mean, wouldn't it be more adequate to write naturalness here and strike it out?
Okay.
Susie.
Okay, so, or, oh, I don't know, naturalness. okay, so, and so maybe Susie could be pushed to higher energies, but it's, I mean, the star model of particle physics is not natural. So, is everyone happy with that? So naturalness is really dead. Nobody is defending naturalness.
So, everybody was a few years ago. Everybody was.
Yeah.
So we learn.
So but
we learn.
We learn.
That's promise.
I guess so. So nature is not natural. Wonderful.
Just a comment about those 200 years. I mean, it's not just time, but it's the time is important because of technology development. It also relies on development in other aspects of science that are not related to the particular thing. So I guess a really burning question that I think about is, what's the chance that, let's say, in another 100 years, we will have enough technology development to probe directly effects that are relevant to quantum gravity? And my personal feeling is, like, if I had to bet on it, I would bet, and I wouldn't bet on that. On the other hand, I don't think it's hopeless. Mm-hmm. One thing that impresses me more than almost anything else, actually, that's happening today is the accuracy of atomic clocks. I mean, there's unbelievably spectacular development in the precision of atomic chronometry. And you know, I don't know how that would relate to quantum gravity or if it ever would, but I could imagine that it might, or that some, you know, 100 years down the road, further extrapolation of that kind of technology would actually lead to something in quantum gravity. So that's one reason I have some hope. Another one has to do with, you know, this remote possibility that quantum mechanics isn't, as we know it, isn't quite right, and that there might be anomalies if we have enough sensitivity to pick up on them, which we probably don't today, but we might in the foreseeable future, where foreseeable probably means beyond my lifetime, but, you know, before the end of civilization.
Which might be
before the end of civilization. We have younger people here, so this is mostly for younger people, probably too bad for us. But ask it.
Yeah, so I think one thing we are missing is the opportunities that arise when we understand how to bring different approaches together. So I think every single approach that we have to quantum gravity has at least one problem that has been really hindering that approach for a significant amount of time. But for many of those, other approaches have either the tools necessary to answer a question like that or concepts that are useful in making progress. And so I think we're really missing out by having a quantum gravity community that is not one quantum gravity community, but that's split in separate communities that spend some amount of their time in fighting against each other and in keeping their grad students from actually working on one, more than one approach and acquiring the expertise that is necessary to bring together approaches. So I think what we are missing or what is keeping us from making progress is in large part the sociology of the quantum gravity.
Very interesting. Francesca,
do
you
want
to say something?
Yeah, well, I wanted to comment, to react to what Ted said. First of all, about the technology. So we have now proposals for quantum gravity experiments that are at reach of our technology, and the time frame could be 5 to 10 years. I'm referring in particular to gravity-mediated entanglement. So this experiment will be giving us witnessing a superposition of different quantum geometries, so superposition of spacetimes. The problem, of course, is that this is just a proof that this would be a proof that gravity is quantized, not of the kind of theory that is underlying, not of the underlying theory of quantum gravity. And regarding the anomalies in quantum mechanics, I think I have the opposite feeling, because it seems to me that there are two possibilities, two ways to explore the space of possible theories in quantum gravity, and there is a more...
Sorry, I just realized this is a little bit offensive.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Hashtag is a good friend, so...
So,
this is
so there are different attitudes in exploring the space of possible theory. One is to postulate new physics behind what we know, and the other one is to be kind of conservative and just to try to understand what is the core of the theory we already have, like quantum mechanics and general relativity. I feel, my feeling, that is just a feeling, is that the solution will come more looking at the conceptual questions in quantum mechanics as we know it and general relativity as we know it. Of course, the resulting quantum theory of gravity may not be the final one. There are maybe some new physics behind that. But to me, the strategy to crack quantum gravity is just to work with the bare ingredients we have somehow.
So nothing is wrong then, you're saying. Yes.
To kind of build off that, and using the example that Chris talked about with the 200 plus years from Newton to Einstein, is that we get the minor discrepancy that was unresolved for Mercury by taking Newtonian gravity very seriously and pushing it as far as we can. And so maybe, like Francesco was saying, the way forward here is to take our current theories, even if we don't think they're ultimately correct, take them as seriously as we can and stress test them as much as we can and look for those sorts of anomalies that are just persistent and won't go away. So that you mentioned at the beginning of today, like anomaly chasing, whether that's, you know, a lot of those haven't stuck around, but maybe that...
But I think maybe there's something to be clear about is that it wasn't the anomaly that led to the development of general relativity. I mean, anomaly, general relativity, as you all know, it was, I guess Einstein developed it in order to, I guess, unify special relativity and gravity and to add this theoretical concern. And eventually, but then the prediction, one of that was the anomaly of the Mercury's predicted precision. So this is the problem with chasing anomalies, is that there are, at any time, there are dozens of them. And people who are familiar with data, if you could see them, and most of them don't stick around long enough. So that's why theoretical guidance is something that's useful. And I mean, I think history is a little bit hard to see, because the ones that have gone away, you never hear about them. Even anomalies that I went on with a graduate student, we never hear about. There were like 5 different detections of dark matter in, there probably still are, but they're different detections.
So to support what you're saying, yeah. During that entire period, I think there was like one decade where there weren't serious anomalies in solar system physics that people were thinking about modifying Newtonian theory to account for. So it's really, there were anomalies throughout that period that all of them except Mercury got resolved by changing the distribution of mass in the solar system, basically, or noticing that the Earth's rotational speed is variable and other sorts of subtle effects.
Good, good. So that is the danger with anomaly chasing. But of course, they are very important to keep track of, but yeah.
Doesn't that suggest a simple solution? The ones that are around for a long time are the ones you're interested in, and those that go away after.
But the thing about this is theoretical guidance is really key, because the reason why Mercury would be interesting is because that's the strongest gravitational field in the solar system, right? So if you think that you've generalized inappropriately from weak gravitational fields to say something which you think is a universal feature of gravity, then you'd look at Mercury as the strongest gravitational field that you have a lot of evidence for to see if you've done that appropriately. And so similarly, the theory will guide you as to what kind of extrapolations you've made into new domains, where you might start worrying, okay, we've extrapolated Einstein gravity from solar system scales to cosmological scales. So we don't think that there's reasons to think that Einstein gravity will fail in the UV because of quantum physics. Do we trust the IR extrapolation in the same way, right? So that's the sort of thing where theory can give you guidance as to, are there modified theories that change the IR behavior of Einstein gravity? How do they do so? This was related to some of the talks this morning about, once you have a theoretical motivation for looking at a space of modified theories, that can tell you which types of observations are going to be the most revealing.
You shouldn't be forgotten that the Mercury precession, 43 arcseconds per century, is less than 1% of the total precession.
Yeah.
So less than 1% effect changed the history of physics. Mm-hmm. This is often forgotten. Less than 1%.
And not taking, if you hadn't taken Newtonian gravity seriously the whole time, you would have been left with, you know.
So I would like to make
much larger discrepancy.
In 1929, Harley published a paper in which they quantized, talked about quantization of electromagnetism. And then they said that if you follow the same methods to quantize gravity, there will not be any difficulties in doing so. 1929, it's only 19 years ago. The next paper was by Matvey Bronstein, a young Russian physicist, who published a paper in 1936. He quantized the gravitational field, and he said that you need an experimental apparatus the size of very large Jupiter in order to detect a graviton. This was followed up by Freeman, Dyson. So the issue is, historically now, this is one of the longest physics endeavors with little success that we've had in history of physics. We're going nearly 100 years now. So when we think about the success of this, finally, I want to produce my personal conclusion.
So, are you saying that it's been too long, or it's not been long enough? This one, I think, because Carlo was saying it's okay, things are going well. 100 years is not too long. But you think it's still okay, or you think it's too long?
No, it's a serious problem.
Okay.
I published papers with collaborators where we produced a finite integrative quantum gravity. It's unitary, it's gasified macrocausality, it involves normal. So we can calculate a finite amplitude for graviton scattering, or graviton scattering off some massive particle, a vector particle. But we can't test it. There are no quantum gravity experiments that can test this. So how can you do physics successfully without experimental data?
So that's an excellent question. So, Laurent.
Sorry, I can wait, but are we still trying to answer that? Or?
Yes, that is the question.
So I look at the blackboard, and there's a big thing which is missing there.
Uh-huh.
which is, it's clearly that, you know, there's one thing in my view that quantum gravity, I mean, I'm not saying going to say predict, but I expect from my experience of quantum gravity, which is missing, and it's you know, UVIR mixing. So, so if you think about the entire theoretical framework in which we analyze data right now, it's the framework of effectivity theory. So I think there's really two possibility for the future. Effectivity theory is correct, and therefore, as quantum gravity, as John is saying, there is no chance of ever detecting it. Or in fact, and I can tell you a list of many, many, many cracks of how the infrared physics in quantum theory is much more rich and different than we thought. Or in fact, the presence of a lens scan, fundamental lens scan, creates, like in condensed matter, UVIR missing. That is the presence of fundamental lens scan, you know, is linked to the phenomena in infrared that you cannot explain without that lens scan. Let me give you an example in condensed matter. Water boils, water cannot boil if there's no UV cutoff. The sky is blue, etc. So I think, yeah, that, and of course, you know, personally, I'm pushing that, and I'm having, and once you try to accept UVIR mixing, and you try to think about what could replace effectivity theory, or you know, upgrade it. So that's, for me, that's the thing which is missing in the discussion.
Thanks, Andreas. In fact, I mean, in some sense, this kept together is in part an homage to UVIR mixing, because we have a lot of people who are talking about possible effects of quantum gravity that can be seen on larger scales. And in fact, on Thursday, we have a panel discussion or a discussion like this, or maybe we decide on the format, which is exactly on UVIR mixing.
Okay.
But let me turn this back on you and ask, is what concrete thing will you, I mean, do you think this is something we should look for, or do you have something concrete that we should be looking for?
Okay, that's maybe a longer discussion, but UVIR mixing means that, yeah, you need to, it's really a theoretical question, because it means that you're going to predict the fact that UV observable is connected to infrared observable. And that is not, the data will never ever tell you that. That is because you're going to have to predict correlation. Okay? And of course, the first one that we have of UVIR mixing, we already have a data, which is the cosmological constant. In one sense, from the field theory point of view, the CC is the most UV observable you can think of, right? Because it's about the Hadamard smallest fluctuations of the vacua and hypersensitivity to UV behavior. But it's also the thing that is the biggest observable in the universe. And so, you know, UVIR mixing means developing a theoretical framework. And I can give you an example where that exists, where, you know, so one example where that exists, and I might end on that, and then you can develop the theory of the phenomenology, is from string theory. So one, often people tell you that string theory predict EFT. I think it's really a false. Yes, it's a false statement for the following reason. One of the fundamental symmetry of string theory is T-duality. And it means that it's very robust, it's non-perturbative, it's true at all order, which means that, you know, anything you get out of string theory should somehow break or you know, be in relationship with T-duality. And T-duality is a built-in symmetry where UV phenomena are always linked to infrared phenomena.
So
that's an example. If string theory was correct, then, you know, you develop it.
So a string theory says, well, that EFT is wrong, right?
Well, I mean, the full. If you really take, it's possible to get EFT out of string theory, but you have to accept that to do that, you have to do a lot of violence to the theory. You have to kind of look at a corner, project states, ignore this fundamental symmetry of the theory.
Okay. So does anyone want to? Okay, Samir.
Okay, I was just trying to maybe say something about the question: what is missing? It seems to me the one big thing that we sort of don't spend that much time thinking about is what is the meaning of this area entropy, the Bekenstein kind of entropy. So everybody knows the value is A by 4 and we all believe it. But if we don't really understand what states contribute to that, then maybe we can't really understand what's going on. And particularly in the cosmological context, people also think that the De Sitter space has an entropy given by the horizon. But it's often used as a statement. But if you could understand a little bit more about what it means, I think that may open up the path towards understanding what quantum gravity is doing in terms of cosmology.
You've been thinking a lot about the meaning of Ariadna, so that's not the same.
I think a lot of people are. I mean, I'm thinking a lot of people.
So
are
yeah, okay. So that's I think that's a good place to look at.
We haven't defined that clue.
I think that's a good place to look at.
We can never see inside a black hole ever.
But we live inside the cosmological horizon, so I think that's more interesting.
How are you going to test it?
But the meaning of de Sitter entropy is more interesting to me because then we live inside the universe, right? So if we have a cosmological horizon, people still think that the area of that horizon might imply some kind of entropy. If you could be precise about what that means, it might teach us something because we live in here. But we don't quite know what to do with it. So I think I was saying it's a good direction.
So I want to hear from five people who haven't talked or are silent, because apparently the old people think everything is fine and going well. They've been working with you. So how about the young people? I mean, is there something that, I mean, on our blind spots, and we just too old to see or hear? Anyone? What do you want to see that you're not seeing it?
Can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay, great. It's Andrew Richards here. I have I've got a PhD. I have an engineering background, but I do spend a lot of time. Have spent a bunch of time working in the realm of gravity and what have you. One thing I wonder, and it may be useful to you guys, I'm not sure, is if the body of theory and calculation that we have at the moment is perhaps blinding us to simpler solutions. I'll give an example of that. If we back up, I think nobody yet has a good definition of the mechanism of gravity. And I think time comes into this a lot. So I wonder if going back to those first principles might help move ahead, if you see what I mean. Going back to simpler, more fundamental things may help move the understanding of quantum gravity ahead further. That's my question. I wonder if that, if there's avoiding a potential blind spot. We've been going down an area of theory, let's say, for 200 years, and we're following that path and keep extending it and extending it and not getting the answer. So maybe I'm trying to say, I guess, maybe the answer is somewhere else, and perhaps, maybe in this forum, it's worthy of perhaps thinking along those lines. So that was my thought.
Thank you very much for your comment. I've been in this building for 15 years, and I've seen people do in every corner and been very open-minded about this. So I don't think people have avoided any simple idea. It's just, at the end of the day, simple ideas, you have to explain data and observations, and things that some things don't work. But I don't think people have been open to ideas, but at the end of the day, you have to work at it. And and see where it goes. And if you have an idea, it's your responsibility to push it because no one else is telling you.
Yeah, that's understood. I'm more suggesting that perhaps in this workshop, instead of pushing the boundaries, pushed back towards the first principles and to simpler things and explore that a little bit. I'm not saying one should, but perhaps there's something interesting in this room that would come out of doing that. That's really what I'm saying. So.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Rob? Well, I'll make a few remarks. I'm younger than John. So I think we're at a time in scientific history where we filled in the modern version of the periodic table. We've discovered every particle in the Standard Model that was predicted. we verified all the main predictions of general relativity with the discovery of gravitational waves,
right.
And there are no
just a minute.
There are no cracks.
What about dark matter?
Just let me finish.
Right.
So in that regard, there are no cracks. Technically, dark energy could be explained by lambda, right? All the data points there. And although we'd like it maybe to be something else, if we're realistic, W equals -1 is, it just keeps honing in there. I agree, dark matter is probably the main empirical thing that is not well understood. But what we're up against is something where the theories work great. Point one, regarding history, point two, it's interesting to hear about the history, but I think the whole history of science in the last 40 to 50 years is radically different than everything that preceded it. We have had the largest army of people working on scientific problems in history by, I would estimate, 2, maybe even 3 orders of magnitude compared to what preceded 1970, just to pick a roughly arbitrary date. And here we are. You could argue that we've been enormously successful in developing the standard model in GR. So my own view, I'm most sympathetic to what Astrid said, merging the different approaches. I think that we shouldn't become too wedded to any particular approach or idea in the subject. And I think that would probably be the safest way to go. So all of these things are good to look at. Regarding anomalies, yeah, they're there all the time. On the other hand, what else are we going to look at empirically, right? Because everything else works. I mean, look, general relativity and the binary pulsar, 14 decimal place agreement between theory and experiment. That's good. That's a pretty hard to find a crack. The one place, maybe the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon, that's still not quite cooperating. But my bet is it's going to be a systematic error in the experiments if I were to bet money. So those are the things I think we need to keep in mind. I don't think we should get too depressed about it. We should do what we can. But it's hard to find cracks.
I'm getting the same feeling from all the people who say nothing wrong and there is no crack.
UV are mixing. It's a bigger.
Okay,
that's a big.
Doran is the young. You're the young.
That's what I wanted to say.
Okay, so this one is, yeah. Okay, so this is the crack. This, we have to work on that. Rickard.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Lee had a comment. I don't know, did you want to unmute or? Should I read your comment?
If you remove dark matter, and all the data fitting beyond the solar system and binary pulsars.
We still cannot hear you.
It does not.
There, can you hear me?
So yes, Lee, go ahead.
Yes, the one thing I have to contribute is that if quantum mechanics break down, the axis along it breaks, I think, is n, where n is the number of entangled qubits. I think our best bet to find things beyond quantum mechanics is to go out to as large n as we can. And it's the corrections that they go in powers of 1 over square root of n are computable and have been computed. And so I think that's the direction which I hope most hope.
So you're saying it goes as 1 over square root of n?
Where n is the number of embedded qubits, or entangled qubits, in the state.
Okay.
And in my talk, I'll discuss that.
Good. Yes, yeah, so we're looking forward to that. Thanks a lot, Lee.
Thank you.
I have another crack.
Another crack.
Yeah, in the spirit of trying to be young. So I'm surprised that it was not mentioned because Robert was here this morning. So for me, it's kind of the fundamental problem of quantum cosmology. And it's a theoretical crack, but it's a big one. That is, you assume very simple things. You just assume that, let's say, if you assume that quantum mechanics is true, that somehow there is an infrared cutoff, you know, the size of the universe, and there is a UV cutoff, then you have a fundamental problem, which is the transplanking problem, which means that, you know, if you take the universe today and you backtrack, and so what did it mean? You have an infrared cutoff, it means that, well, okay, and a UV cutoff And at some point, it means that there's only so many degrees of freedom per Planck area or per Planck volume. So if you backtrack down to the Big Bang, where are they all coming from? And so the option you have is to, you know, and it's such a simple fundamental problem, and I'm surprised that quantum cosmologists really are not focusing on that. Of course, our understanding of EFT is completely against that. The fundamental problem of EFT is somehow the statement that if you take any state, so we agree on what is the problem. The problem is that, you know, UV cutoff, fundamental cutoff. One solution is the breakdown of unitarity in quantum mechanics. I mean, if you don't believe that, that's an option, but, you know, it's a big crack. It's also incomplete, again, it's incomplete, if you want, contrast with the tenets of EFT. Every single one of our predictions, so, is about effectivity theory. We have to remember that the success we're talking about is the success of EFT. EFT predicts that if you take any state, no matter how complicated it is, and you zoom in the UV, it's going to look like the vacuous state. It's completely featureless. This is the okay.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, that's a very good point. I wish we had a defender of an effective field theory here. Kurt Burness is not here. I'm sure he would object, but he's not here. So, Francesca.
I mean, one of the problems you are pointing at, Laurent, is the Trans-Planckian modes in cosmology, but this is not a problem of general relativity nor a problem of quantum mechanics. It's a problem of having a cosmological model that is based on inflation. So, okay, then, I mean, if you wanted to put inflation together with quantum gravity, okay, we can discuss this, but I think of these as two separate things.
No, I try to phrase it independently of a model. That's, you know, whether, I mean, I try to phrase it as you need three things. You need to believe in quantum, like you need a UV cutoff, an infrared cutoff, and a universe that expands. That's all you need.
Yeah.
And that's it. And then you have a fundamental problem. I mean, inflation relies on the statement about EFT that there's nothing new at UV scale. But what I'm saying is that this problem is really.
So, I mean, even if you don't have inflation, every scale you see today, at some point it was very, very small, right? So, I guess that's the point, is that. Some point it was sub-Planckian.
Not necessarily sub-Planckian.
If you have UV and infrared cutoff and the universe comes from something, then at some point you're compressed in your degrees of freedom.
But you need an accelerated expansion, the inflation, to get the strength.
I mean, it could be less than the accelerated. It could be slow at some point, unless you...
Okay.
You have to address that. You could say there's a bounce at the moment, the number of degrees of freedom and the size, you know, whatever, but it's kind of a, you know, it's whatever happens, it violates the central tenets of effectivity theory, which is universality of the vacuum.
You can tough it out, mind over matter, and I can pour you into an Uber.
I think it's a different, yeah, sorry, obviously. So, Carlo? Yeah, Carlo. So, I'm just looking for younger people, like quiet people, let's say. Does anyone else want to?
Yeah, here's the way I ask.
Okay.
Why in the world did you bother going into this field? But there must be some.
Exactly.
Where do you see the problem?
What's wrong with
the
problem?
You're talking about the young people.
Young
yeah.
people, yes.
Yes.
Right, exactly. Where do you want to go? Who's the youngest person?
Okay, that is one.
I don't have a suggestion, but to answer your question, the fact that it's so hard and that everyone seems to argue and have no idea, like that's the exciting part to me. That's why I wanted to learn about it, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's very hard, that's the reason. Very hard, no idea.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I'm also a student, still getting my PhD, but one thing I want to comment on is I think it's similar to, you know, when you're like finding life on other planets, where do you look? Water. I think a lot of older physicists, they like to go down the approaches that they know and love. And as a student, I get to learn those approaches that you know and love. I have to, on my own, then find, you know, little less mainstream approaches. So I think one way to kind of crack some of these problems is if the older physicists who understand why the other models failed if they would be able to communicate that better, so then we don't go down those roads on our own, you know? So like for one example, I think that like I still can't find an answer to is like dark matter, right? I'm interested in the problem of dark matter, but for some reason, everywhere I look in the mainstream, we always go to a particle approach. But why? You know, from my perspective of it, it seems like the gravitational effect. Why do we naturally always want to go back to a quantum field or to a particle approach versus maybe looking for different dynamics in other forms of gravity? You don't get to learn that as a graduate student because we're kind of got to go to these more mainstream approaches. So that'd be kind of like one thing I would look into more, but.
That's a very cool point. So anyone wants to add to that?
Yeah. Yeah, well, as responsible supervisors, if you tell us you would like to have a job in physics afterwards, it's our responsibility to give you the best possible chance for that. And sadly, that means that you know, we're going to advise you to follow the sort of consensus. But I'm sadly also being one of these older physicists, but I certainly don't like to think the same way. In fact, I think that's part of the problem with quantum gravity. Everybody's sort of assuming that we've got to do quantum mechanics the way that we like to do quantum mechanics, instead of thinking, well, maybe both things actually give and we've got to do something completely different. Anyway,
so just sorry, I have a few things I'm trying to ask. So Lee says that he strongly disagrees with you, Ruth.
Oh, excellent.
I strongly disagree with you. I think that, in my experience, first of all, the students who went out on their own ideas did as well as the students who were mainstream. And I think it's not the problem, it's not the trouble. The problem is that individuals don't take enough risk. And that includes us and that includes the students. But everybody I've known who took real risks, they paid off.
Well, maybe you knew sort of people right at the top end, but I've certainly seen plenty of people who don't necessarily make it. It's probably selection bias as well, Lee. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to actually follow the whole population to see whether it works or not. It's just that is what people feel. You feel that you want to give people the best chance, and you know how hard it is being different.
Sorry.
Look around in the room that we're in right now. There's Carlo, there's Ted, just for starts, there's Laurent, there's many people who took real risks and never looked back, and they're doing very well.
Nail. I'm just saying it.
Yeah. So I just wanted to say, I mean, there are different points of view, and I think actually it's bringing us back to, in fact, one of the things I wanted to talk about, which is the very first part, which is, it's not all about the science and ideas, it's about people and how we can include them. And there is this issue with, there is a paradox, same way that general relativity and quantum mechanics have a contradiction, or they're not consistent. There is a type of a contradiction between people trying to do new things and finding a community mm-hmm. where you could belong to and find jobs in, basically. So if you start a new idea, there is no guarantee that idea catches on, and then there will be no one who may hire you. But if you keep working on something that already exists a community for, say people who do holography or string theory, for example, where there's a big community, then it might be easier to get a job.
Or more competition.
Yeah.
And there is more competition.
Ways, doesn't it? Yeah.
So it's not obvious that, I mean, obviously there might be also more competition. So it's a very hard calculation for you to know whether this may work or not.
I wouldn't include string theory. You're not, string theory is not dominant anymore. There are no experimental tests of string theory.
So on that, I think Sammy wanted to say something. I don't know if you still want to say.
Yeah, I had a general comment also, maybe going back to something that was mentioned before. there are many, many different areas of quantum gravity, and we were talking a little while before about, you know, how disconnected we get. But also in the context of what's being said now, I would really value a set of nice, easily written review articles for graduate students, where we could actually learn more about other fields of quantum gravity. So for example, even young people in string theory, if you ask them to reproduce the basic like calculation of Strominger-Buffer entropy of black holes, which might be the one major thing we got out of string theory, one should be able to have a review article by which everybody can learn that, so you can go on the board, start here, and get the answer on the other side, A by four. But hardly anyone can do that because like got buried in these very technical old papers. But something like that, I would like to learn about loop quantum gravity or about Rabe gravity, something very simple, very readable. So I think that could help the graduate students as well, getting into the field.
Very good. So, Ken. Sorry, let's hit Ted and then.
Yeah, this is not a profound point, but I wanted to respond to the student comment about asking whether dark matter could be modified gravity instead of particles. I just wanted to make sure, I mean, most people know this, I think, but there's been plenty of research looking at the possibility that it's modified gravity, and it's extremely difficult to construct a theory that's consistent with other things that are already known and confirmed. So I just don't think you should get the wrong impression that, you know, nobody has tried this. There isn't very much activity in it today because it hasn't succeeded. It's too difficult. There are too many problems with the idea. That doesn't say that, you know, some tweak of the idea might not somehow work in the future, but there's been a lot of effort and it's not worked out.
Also the bullet plastic.
Yes, and John has done it. But I think we have 5 minutes, so I just want to see. So there's Robin. Steve, did you say somebody's gone?
Oh, Lee hasn't heard that.
Oh, yeah, okay, Lee's gone now. Okay, so Rob.
Well, I was going to add a few minutes ago something to the list. It's a bit related to what was said in quantum. I think we still have a pretty poor understanding of the quantum classical interface. We don't really understand very well what it means for a system to be, quote, classical, and what it means to be, quote, quantum. I mean, I've done some research myself with some students in my group, and there are some working on that. Understanding chaotic phenomena from a quantum viewpoint is also not well understood. So it may be studying those areas will shed light on some of these other things. That's all. I just wanted to add that to the partial list, well, partial, but to this list of things. And one other comment regarding job versus mainstream, I'm more in Ruth's category. The farther you depart from the mainstream, the riskier it gets. It's just a simple fact. And now you've got to make sure students don't just do add a bell and whistle kind of physics. But I get stuff all the time from people that think they've solved the problems of the universe with quantum gravity. And I know people more senior than me say they put that in the crackpot file. So you've got to find that right balance of something that is interesting enough to be worth doing, but something that really gives the students a realistic chance. Anyway, obviously I saw hands go up, so probably I'm going to
answer that. That's good. So I have Chris and then Carlo.
I was just going to say we've been focusing on kind of the individual level decision of how students or supervisors decide which projects to work on. There's also the community level decision about how to use resources wisely and how to prioritize having a lot of people working in one area versus having a spread of different areas. And I think it'd be interesting to have a discussion of how, I mean, I don't know if anyone here is in a position to make those sorts of decisions, but like how is the group structured? And if we want to have more sort of integrating of different approaches, then there's ways that could be achieved by rewarding people for writing the kinds of review articles that were mentioned earlier. And I just don't know if that's something that's actually incentivized in the way things work now.
So this is an excellent point. So I think we have an excellent opportunity here. We have a diverse group of people in this room and online. I see Lee has his hand up. I get to you in a minute. And we get to decide what may be done in the next 10, 15 years. If we can convince each other, of course, if we all keep fighting with each other, then nothing may come out of this. But if we can come to ideas that we can cohesively push together, then indeed we may make community level decisions that individuals cannot make, and that could make a difference.
So I had Carlo and then Lee. Carlo.
About student respect for jobs and being mainstream or not, I would like to separate two things, which I think make a confuse the issue.
I could take the call, Laurie.
Sorry.
Excuse me.
Sorry.
Mute.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it is has always been true and is still true that for a student it's extremely difficult, almost impossible to get a position unless he has succeeded to convince one or two or a small committee of people that he's good and has done something interesting or might do something interesting.
So they are good.
Could be. So or she. Or they.
So in that sense, it's required for to get some acceptance from the old guys because and that I don't see an alternative that if there is. However, this has nothing to do with being mainstream, because a lot of people I know got hired not by a large community that all is doing and there for, but by one or two or three or a small group that say, oh, that's interesting. That was certainly my own experience and a lot of experience with my friends. When I was a student, everybody was doing something else. I was doing anomalies in quantum field theory. I was doing something that just three people in the world were doing. Those three people got convinced that I was doing something interesting. So don't confuse being in a large community, being accepted by main big mainstream things, with being accepted by.
Is that make sense? I think it's
yeah.
Not fair there. Right,
no, it's the opposite, I'm saying.
Exactly.
I was not in any network. I just
didn't. But it's the right people, right?
Yeah, it's a network, even if it's a network of two or
if
three.
It's a network of a few people, yeah. It's still a network, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, I know brilliant people who didn't work and convinced one faculty and got a job.
Okay, so it's convinced the right people. Okay. So maybe they're not this.
Whoever the right people are.
Right people.
Whoever has a position.
Okay.
That's a, so, but that's somehow it goes in the other direction. It's easier to convince one person by having an original idea than being chosen within a big list.
But you need to convince a committee to hire you, right? Because there's a hiring committee. So that's, I mean, it's more than one person usually, unless it's a very powerful person.
Right. And then if I well, just one sentence, if I had a advice to give young people in quantum gravity now, after decades of theoretical groping in the dark and trying to put things, is what have been come out. So focus on how to connect the tools that have been developed in these decades to actual observations. That thing is not clear yet.
So, very good. Thank you.
Whether it's the universe or dark matter or black holes, that seems to me the hot thing in the next years. Hot in the sense of promising thing. In the
so by tools, you mean theoretical tools, right?
Yeah, connect the existing theoretical tools to the astrophysics, because that's what we seems to be here, to the cosmology.
Go ahead, Lee.
Yeah, so one thing, I think Carlo is being too modest to mention it, but Samir asked for a good textbook, a good simple book to learn the quantum gravity. And Carlo and Francesca have written two of them. I think some others are written by Jorge Poulin and Gambini, and there are a number of others as well. On a more mathematical level, Ashtekar has written three or four books. So the books are there, and we certainly encourage you to look at them, and we'd be happy to answer any questions. I want to point out, as far as the success of loop quantum gravity in a provisional way, I think that people are not, don't notice how impressed people are. I mean, here at Perimeter, we're one place, but we have placed something more than 20 postdocs in the last 15 or so years. In good faculty positions where they remain. And that has set up therefore, a research area which is not string theory, which has a decent supply of funding and jobs. And that's, if you look at it, that's amazing. And the only way to explain it, I think, is that actually enough people believe that it's good physics, that it's happened not just one time, but over and over again, that the people doing the quantum gravity won the faculty position.
That's excellent. Thanks a lot, Lee. That's essentially a point that even if you're not the mainstream, you can succeed. I think that's a good lesson to end on. Is there any other?
Yes, one more comment.
Okay.
I repeat that after over 90 years, there's still no quantum gravity observation data. This is correct. If anyone has an observation they can produce in this room, tell me about it.
And or you could wait until the next, like you have time until tomorrow, I think. But you have a whole week, so